actually, is somebody whose yard site is tonight, actually, and that's the Aruch Lener. The Aruch Lener, I don't know if most of you probably are familiar with the Sfarim, with some of the Sfarim sometimes, but the person was a much bigger, he was a whole tkufa, and in many ways he's the foundation for a lot of the fighting against, standing up to reform movement, and it's a very incredible life to explore. Basically, Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger was in Germany. He was born in 1798 and was niftan in 1872. He was most of his life the Rav of Altoona, which was a sort of part of Hamburg, and that's basically spent most of his life. The Sfarim he wrote was the Aruch Lener, is his main sefer. Bikur Yaakov is his first sefer. It's on Hilchos Lulav and Sukkah. He wrote the Aruch Lener, Minchas Ani on Drush, and the Shuvas Binyan Tzion. I guess let's start. So first of all, we always speak about where I got my information from. So there is really there's a little bit in two places. There is in the new Shuvas of the Aruch Lener that they put out. They have in the Hakdama told us of his, and they had in a journal, they had in Hanemon, it's sort of a German Jewry type of journal in Hebrew, they had a write-up on him, and this, it's the same material recycled with different twists and turns depending on who's writing it. You get a little bit of an angle, different angle. And basically, his own tshuvas and mamarim are pretty much what we have to go on. So again, a lot of material I'll take out from the tshuvas. He wrote mamarim that were translated in Hebrew. He wrote mamarim that were in German. And basically, that's what we'll go with. Okay, so let's start. So let's understand a little bit the tkufa that he was in. In the 1700s, the world started changing. Revolutionary ideas, progressive ideas, liberal ideas, and as far as the Jewish community went, the end of the 1700s was when Mendelssohn was active. It was a lot more ideas being batted around, wealthier Jews, their lifestyle being nominally Orthodox, but really no content of frumkeit to it. There was a lot of things happening inside. They were really pretty much eating away at the neshama of Yiddishkeit in Western Europe more. France and the parts of Germany, French had captured, and Germany, and so on. In 1810 the early 1800s, lay people in Germany began, somebody named Jacobson, Isdal Jacobson, they began to make changes in the ritual of the synagogues, making up their, they have their own temple. They had a siddur that they published with some changes. And really it was more, as I would say, sort of a grassroots movement of some sort where people started doing things, changing things and so on. In the mid 1800s, 1840s, there was a conference of rabbis in Brunswick where they came out with statements about what they feel is right news and what not, what should be changed. And that's really became much more public part of the reform movement. And German Jewry fell apart extremely quickly, and possibly because it had been eating up all along. And Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger was really the Rebbe of two of the people that would have the most profound influence in bringing back whatever they could salvage of German Jewry. So let's speak about his own. He was born in 1798, which was basically the same year that the Vilna Goyim was Nifta. That's where his history starts from. He was born in a German town called Karlsruhe, which means the resort area of Prince Karl's, of King Karl. His early years, he learned by a son of the Shagas Aryeh. The son of the Shagas Aryeh, Reb Usher, was a rab there, and he taught him. So he's linked back to the previous generation. He then went, as he got older, he went to a city called Würzburg, which had a yeshiva, a real yeshiva, big, I don't know how big, but it was an established yeshiva. The head of that yeshiva was somebody named Reb Avrom Bing. Reb Avrom Bing was a Talmud of Reb Nosson Adler. Reb Nosson Adler, maybe sometime we'll speak about him, was an extraordinary figure. Reb Nosson Adler was a mystic of sorts, huge, a Talmud Chacham beyond words. He lived in Frankfurt. The community did not like it because he davened Nozchari and he duchened, and he had all sorts of, he had to keep a minyan to himself only. He was a Rebbe of Chassam Sofer. When the Chassam Sofer would mention Nosson Adler's name, he would turn white and start shaking. That's who Reb Nosson Adler was. Anyone who was a Talmud of his spoke about him in terms that were incredible. He was a mysterious person. We know him through his Talmidim. So Chassam Sofer was on Talmud, and Reb Avrom Bing was another Talmud. He had a yeshiva in Würzburg. And the Aruch Lener went to learn in Würzburg. He learned by him. A colleague of his was somebody named, who would later be known as Chacham Barnes, who was a little bit of a Rebbe of Shlomo Hirsch also, and of Hildesheimer. Chacham Barnes was a big Talmud Chacham, but more into philosophy, things of that nature. And he was an instrumental figure in German Jewry also. So he was a colleague of the Aruch Lener. The Aruch Lener had more of a feel for learning Lomdis, Iyun, Halacha, much more in that frame. But they were Chaverim. He learned in Würzburg, and he also went to university in Würzburg. Very unclear exactly as to what he was doing and why and so on. And this is, depending on whose account you read, you get two different versions. One version of it is that it was natural. Germans were into education, and he was, you know, he was German, and it was something that was natural. He actually spoke, he was highly educated, he spoke a fluent German, and he was a beautiful orator, and he knew a lot about many things. There are people who see it very differently. They present it that it was a big b'di'eved. He himself had 1,000 times charata, and he wished he didn't go, but he had to do it because it was Eslas Lashem, and he had to do it to go against the other people, and a lot of everybody quotes selectively. He does write that it's a big sakana, and he does write that it's something that he needed shmira from. Doesn't write that he shouldn't have done it. On the other hand, he doesn't write that it's lachatchila. He never spoke about it much, but tachlis was, he was extremely sophisticated. He spoke marvelously. In his later years, King Wilhelm of Prussia met him, and he was blown away by him. He said he'd never seen somebody as aristocrat like him, and he actually turned him down. He asked Aruch Lener to participate in some evening the next evening, and he very politely refused and told him it's Som Gedalia, not going to go to any evening somewhere in Som Gedalia, and so on. And the king was blown away by him. So he definitely had, and in a lot of his tshuvas, he dealt with more modern type of technology, things like that. And he was very familiar and so on. So hard to know how to interpret it. But tachlis was, he did go to university. In some places I see it says he went for 1 year. Some places it says he basically finished. What did happen was there were German pogroms at the time called Hep-Hep riots. I think Hep-Hep is some sort of abbreviation for go to Palestine. Jews should go to Palestine. And he was attacked. He was in a room and he had to jump out through a back window and run away. And that was the end of his university career. He wasn't interested in going back anymore, and he left and so on. So he was a Talmud of Reb Avrom Bing. He had studied university, and then he became, at a very young age, in his 20s, he got married, and he had he had 7 kids, and his wife was Nifter. They were married 13 years, and he remarried again. At the age of 28, I think it is, he became the Rav and Rosh Hashiva of a Kloiz in Mannheim. Mannheim is was a city that had a dedicated Beis Medrash with an endowment fund for people to sit and learn. A sort of what we would call a kibbutz yeshiva today. And he became Rosh Hashiva of it, and he had Talmidim and Chashva Talmidim over there. And Shlomo Shaphal Hirsch learned by him for a year when he was in Mannheim. And he was one of the people who had a lot of influence on him as a tzura of a Rav in Halach and many other areas. He was there 10 years in Mannheim. By the way, if you want to get a sense of how much German Jewry and knowledge and so on had plummeted, the Shagasari's son, Reb Asher, who taught him, wrote that he sees that Germany is going to pot because there's no Talmud Torah, and he worked very hard and made a takana that everybody has to send his kid to learn Gemara until at least he's 13 years old. And he feels very good about that takana. It was in Skabel in a lot of places and so on. But that was where it was holding. That was the matzav then in those days. From Mannheim, he then went on to become Rav. He was there 10 years. And the Rabbanis in Altoona opened up. Altoona was a major Jewish city. It was a city that included in itself Hamburg, Altoona, Würzburg, I think, was the third one, Ahu, Kehillas Ahu, and it was a very prestigious Rabbanis. He became Rav there for till he was Nifta. That was his Rabbanis. So, and that's where he stayed. He became the Rav there, and he had a yeshiva there, and that was him. He was the Rav of Altoona, and that's what he was known at. Altoona was a very famous city. Reverend Eibishes has been Rav there, and so on. By the way, one of the people who writes about the history of that tekufa writes that the reason why Talmud Torah had disintegrated in Germany was because the fight of Rabbi Yaakov Emden, Reverend Eibishes, took the good taste away from everybody, and people became nimis in it. Somebody blames it on Rabbi Yaakov Emden, on his Melchama, and Rabbi Yonis Eibishitz had a big yeshiva, and he was the most profound Torah personality in that area, and it was because of that war and that machlokas that Torah dissipated. But be it as it may, he was a Rav when things were going downhill terribly. To his credit, as long as he was Rav in Altoona, no one did open up, change any minhagim, even if they weren't frum, but the respect for him was incredible, and michpe chvoidoy, a lot of things were kept in check. The German Jews had that level of dachatz, even if they were not terribly committed, and they were respectful of him. Some interesting points about his fight with the reform movement and so on. So, first of all, one of the things that he's very proud of, that he made, that he feels was very, very important, he made a journal, a newspaper / journal that came out as a weekly for 5-6 years. It was called Shomer Tzion HaNe'eman. And it included Pilpul Divrei Torah, new Rishonim that they uncovered with all sorts of, writings on it, Kisviyadis, occasional arguments against reform, but not much or many. Very not clear. In other words, he felt very strong that this was a very important defense line against reform. Not clear. In other words, it wasn't like articles against them. Occasionally, on a rare occasion, there'd be an article about it, that wasn't a steady diet of it. It was a lot more like a Torah journal of sorts, with articles, letters, writings, shilas and shuvas. I don't know. I think he felt more that it would give a sense of togetherness, unity, existence to the Torah community. We're not nobody. We're here. He resisted coming out very strongly and openly against reform. And it's fascinating. He invited Reb Shlomo Eger, Reb Eger's son, to come visit him and to talk over the issue of reform. Reb Eger's son, Reb Shlomo Eger, said that in his community, I assume it was Posen, they had, you know, sort of removed them from, they removed Reform Jews from the pale of Yiddishkeit, and they made separate kehillas and threw them out. He was against it. And he writes that the reason is as follows. Reb Shlomo Eger writes this in a letter that he went to visit him. He said that Reb Yaakov Edlicker was, you know, gave him covered malachim, and yet he refused. He said, German Jews respect Rabbanim. They will hold on to what they're told to do so long as it's part of the Kehillah. If we go against them and make two separate Kehillahs, then he said many innocent, unlettered, to me, mistaken people who don't know anything will go with them and not with us. And then we'll lose them. And for their sake, we can't do that. So it's interesting. It gets into the same thing. The same attitude gets interpreted in two ways. The more moderate people, right, that the Aruch Lener says that it's also to split the kehillas, like Rav Kook, that this is, it's mamish, it's the worst thing possible is to split a Jewish kehillah, and it's Yahar Vayava not to do that. The Kanoim felt that he was tainted somewhat with the German mindset, and, you know, it was forgivable, they had tremendous achats for him, but they sort of, or they saw it as only a b'dievet. But it was kind of interesting. It was a point that he sort of tread a very fine line between what the toelis is of doing these things, and it gets interpreted as people wish to interpret it. Everybody likes to make things also with their own shittas, and he gets put into both boxes by each side, a kanoim amongst kanoim and a moderate amongst moderates. He did come out with an 1840, in the 1844, I think, they had this conference in Brunswick where they had a handful of quote-unquote rabbis, I think it was 20-some-odd rabbis, who said that, you know, basically, Torah Shabbat is over, and you don't need this, you don't need that. And he wrote he wrote a big letter against it, a big mimer, but it was in German. And the Ksav Sofer wrote to him, Hayitochen. In Hungary, the big battle was not to use the language of the Goyim. So you Rabbanim write a letter totally in German? So he said, well, nobody understands Hebrew. So what's the point of writing a letter in Hebrew if they only speak German? So Ksav Sofer said, so write in Hebrew and translate in German. But Rabbanim have to write a letter in Hebrew, and he gave him a nusach. He retranslated his German into Hebrew and sent him and said, this print as the Hebrew letter, and then add to it the German that he wrote, and that's okay, I'm fine with that. Basically, it seemed to have had such a fine balance of it. He was very involved in Eretz Yisrael activities. And it's interesting, here also, there's something of the future political issues that would come up. He was head of Kollel Hoyd, which is Holland, Germany. They supported people living in Eretz Yisrael. We spoke about it when we spoke about Rabbi Chaim Zonnefeld. And he was also recognized by many of the Poskim in Eretz Yisrael as very chashev. They would send him occasion shaylas. He raised money to build houses in Eretz Yisrael, and the old city, Batei Machsa, is built by him, or helped by him. After his death, they dedicated one or two of those apartments, called them Beis Yaakov L'Ilui Nishmasai, and Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnefeld lived in that apartment, and Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnefeld was extremely, he had tremendous haracha for him. He himself, the Ksav Sofer, bought him a set of Aruch Lener because he saw how much he wanted it. And he would give it many times to Bar Mitzvah President Aruch Lener because he held it gives you a yashrus in how to learn. It's galat. He was extreme yashrus, like a person. And everything he said was no pilpul, to the point, and with shikl hadas. But Reb Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, who was one of the early, sort of what we would call Mizrahi Rabbanim, was Adam Gadol, who very much was for building up Eretz Yisrael. He wrote a sefer, a maimer sefer, about being makriv karbonis bisman hazeh, that you can bring karbonis bisman hazeh, even though there's no beis hamikdash, no mizbeach, can still bring karbonis. And he sent it around, and the Aruch Lener wrote a maimer against it, and he called it binyan tzion. And it's interesting, he didn't deal with all the halachic issues. He basically said, it says, v'lo ariach nichoichechem, one of the klolos of Golos HaKadosh Baruch Hu no longer wants our kabbanis. And there's no point in bringing kabbanis when there's a v'lo ariach, until Mashiach comes and there's a rasim for kabbanis. He even said he wasn't sure if halachically it's not yoytze, but it's wrong to do that. And Tzir Shkalsh was very upset. He said they should have called it Churban Tzion, not Binyan Tzion, the thing he wrote. And he says, how with Divrei Agada can you knock off, you know, a halachic binyan of mine? But the truth was, Tzir Shkalsh was interested in sort of forcing Mashiach's hands. You know, I mean, it was out of Gadol and everything, but the point was, we'll go to Tzisrael, we'll bring Karbanis, we can do it. And he was against it. And many Gedolim held like him. It's now's the time HaKadosh Baruch Hu was not interested in it. Don't push it, don't force it. But this was an early harboring of future machlokes on this. You know, the many Reb Shlomo Hirsch was more strongly against it, but it was a more developed movement in his times. So he was involved in Yisrael activities with that. His shilas and tshuvas included many interesting things. And I'll just read a few interesting things that I picked out. They've been reprinted in a decent print, actually, a very nice print, a while back. It's called Shailos HaTshuvos HaAruch Lener, and has Binyan Tzion, and then it has, after that, it has a collection of stuff, some Chidushim he wrote, and odds and ends, and an intro, which is a biography that's collected from the other stuff. So here we have a tshuva. Somebody asked him in Binyan Tzion HaNeman, in his newspaper, they want to make a takon in his town that only one shul and only one person should have as a chazan, and he should have special clothing. He wasn't sure if this person is a frum person or this person is reform, and he needed to be cagey about it. And he writes, this takonat dav one shul, if you really mean l'shem shemayim, and it's done for the dignity of davening, okay. But this is the type of thing that reform people sometimes use shalom l'shem shemayim, because basically they let you dav only one shul, and then they do exactly what they want to do. He says, to wear these begodim? I don't know where you got this from. Where does it say a chazan has to wear these special begodim? And actually, he wanted to compare it to Big Day Kahuna. He said, to tell me that if a person, a chazan, is not wearing those black gowns with a hat, it's like a koin is mechus Big Day, mechus begodim. It's absolute rubbish, he says. Our uniform is a talis, and that's what you should stick with. So he basically felt that this person was trying to get something out of him that he didn't want, and he sort of answered like that. That's one interesting tshuva. Another tshuva that I found sort of was interesting is from Reki Vega. Reki Vega wrote to him. This is B'yoyim Dalet B'Shabes Bezer Shchesh Cheshmin Tov Kof Tzadik Zayin, 1837. It's actually 1836, because in Cheshvan, Takzaz is still Takzav. He says, Tremarmano Karno Sadik Yaakov Ishtam Yesh Vaholim Kvoy Didi Rav Vachulu Rabbi Yaakov Etlinger Abbezna Altuna. He says, thank you very much for sending me your sefer that's called Bikuri Yaakov on Hilchas Sukkos and Lulav. Even though I have a lot of work and I'm very, very weak, but because I really like you so much, I learned through the sefer, and I wanted to be able, b'cholofen, to be able to be infallible with you. So he has all sorts of auras on it, and he places where he feels he's right, and then he writes about one of them. Sifkat Gimel, he says, Baruch Hashem. I was your bar mazel, and I was mechaven to your great das in learning Pshat Naguda, and I'm very, very happy with that. It's quite a haskamer kivega. Kivega writes about you. I'm so fortunate that I was mechaven to you in Ladait Chagadol. Rabbi Kivega also adds a little note at the end. I please asking you that the only thing you should write, the only title you should ever use is Harav, and that's it. No other titles. He also promised to look at it in a short kufa and write more, but he was nifter. There is he writes about, I was asked das Torah, basically, from a Jewish perspective, how do you look at an organization in Frankfurt that's based on the following axioms? That you can change Moshe Rabbeinu's Torah whenever you want, based on circumstances. The Talmud and all of Torah Shabbat Peh is not relevant for a Jew. We do not hope for Mashiach. Bris Milah was given only to Avram, and it's not binding on Klal Yisrael. So what's the Hashkafah Das Torah? How to look on this? I need not tell you what he writes about it. But he says, I'm not quite sure what what you want. And he writes he says something. He says very interesting taina. He says, if this attitude were to reach Goyim and so on, then everything would be lost, because you can change anything you want, you can so on and so forth. Very interesting. I'm curious to know what exactly was the point of it and so on. But at the end he writes, and this is his attitude, that he says as follows. We want to yusal Kadosh Baruch Hu sheyiftach es einei hatoyim ha'ela, that he should open the eyes of all these people who have gone off the derech, v'sheyachso oisam l'cheik ha'tor v'muna, he should bring back to v'muna, v'kach yavad l'kol Yisrael ha'mu'uchad b'sholem min ha'cherim ha'ketz yomim, and all Klal Yisrael be oivet HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So he doesn't deal much with klolos, but he says that he hopes they all go back, they all do tshuva. This is a very interesting tshuva on machine matzis. They started making his days, this is Tof Reish Yutes, so that's 1859. And again, it's Tavis, so it's either or, it's either 1859 or 1860. There was a huge fight broke out in Europe about machine matzis. Most of Chassidus were against it. The Sholem, Yosef Sholem Natanzin, the Sholem Meishiv was for it, and Rebbe Yaakov Atlinger was for it. So he writes like this. He says, you wrote me a letter asking about making machine matzis and our kehillah. Says, yes, in my kehillah, I paskin that they should do it with machine matzis. I'm very happy because it's much more kosher, it's quicker. And it's true, in the beginning, I was worried about, I'd heard that pieces fall off and stuff like that, and that they're all pieces that stick inside, it's very hard to clean it. So I made I set up a system how they should cut the matzahs and what they should do, not make long pieces. I worked out a system in how to make it work well. And he says, besides which, I also told them they should make the matzahs round, because people were used to round matzahs, and they sort of didn't feel comfortable using square matzahs. So I said they should do it with like a quick wheel. They should cut it so that it's round, but it should not be, it should be machine matzah, but round machine matzah. He says, and he had a whole system how they make sure it's clean and nothing happens. He said, I'm very happy, and all people, all your HMIMs feel that these machines are wonderful. And he said, I wonder that you told me that there are Rabbanim in his country who asked it. I think those Rabbanim mean l'shem shemayim, but they have no idea how a machine works. And ein adei mishmir l'riyah. And then he brings here on the bottom in the notes that a lot of the people who asked it said, I don't know, I'm not sure about it. I don't know how it works. I've never seen it. I heard from somebody. And so on. He said, I don't know why, I mean, you know, they probably just don't know what they're talking about. He said, if their attitude is that chadash asim in HaTorah, that you can't do anything that's new, he says, we, Yekeshu Rabbanim, also are very strong about not doing new things. He says, but that has to do with Torah and mitzvahs. We don't change Torah and mitzvahs. But what has to do with machines and technology, why not get the best out of it to make the best out of our mitzvahs? You know, chadash of the Torah means change the nusach or anything like that. That we don't do. Now, but if they made a machine that makes matzah better, why wouldn't you want to do it with that? That was his, and that was his attitude to a lot of things. If you take a look, he has quite a few tshuvas on all sorts of new things and so on. He went to check everything. He never wrote a tshuva, he went, looked at it, checked it. It sometimes he couldn't get, someone drew him pictures of something, and he said he doesn't get it, he wants to see it actually the nicer. He was machma mesiris. For instance, when it came to eating birds that have no mesiris, even though they seem to have simonim, but since there's a different mesiris, he would not change that. He has, this is a very interesting letter over here, which is a girl's graduation. Maybe I'll go through, there's one more tshuva that's a fascinating tshuva, and it really speaks more about what life was like, and it also speaks about how things haven't changed in some ways. There was a tshuva from there was a village in Hungary where the husband, there were two people in that village who traveled for weeks on business. And once he went away on a business trip, the two of them went away on a business trip, and a very, very big tzaddik came to town. He was somebody that wouldn't eat anything from animals and sleep on the floor week, take ratzoises. And he asked the lady if he could stay by her. She had children and servants, I guess there was no problem, yichud. And she said yes. And he was there for a week and a half. And he would like take a chatzos and sleep on the floor and not eat anything and this and that. And then one night he came to her bedroom and he said that he's Eliyahu Navi and that he's found such wonderful tzaddikas like her and they'll have Mashiach together. And he can prove it absolutely, because after he leaves, 3 days after he leaves, there'll be a big box. There's a big box under the bed. It'll be filled with 400 huge gold coins. Can't get better proof than that, can you? And she lived with him. And then he left. And 3 days later, she opened the box and there was nothing there. So she realized that she was fooled. And she's, you know, and the Shaila came to him. And it was very hard to find a heter. It came to many dollars, but it was not possible at all to find a heter. He has an interesting. He looked at it from the angle of Eidus and so on, whatever it is. But Al Kopanim, you know, and he writes in a very little twist. He writes here Osa Kislosa. It's a takeoff from a pasuk in Eov. It means a stupid piety. In other words, kislosa means foolishness, yir ascha, it means yir yira. It was a twist on the word to mean like she was a very stupid person, but she meant it, she meant well. She was very unlettered, unlearned, and that's what she meant. There's a letter, there's one of the mamarim they have printed here. And again, when you're trying, the people who are not in Germany saw him as like a Shem Eger, as one of this, a regular East European Rav who's fighting Mechabes Hashem in Germany, except maybe he dodges in German. Like, that's the only thing that he concedes. He has here a public test for the girls in the girls' school. in Germany. Now, a girls' school, this is 1867. And in Europe, in Eastern Europe, there wasn't even yet a Havmin to have a girls' school. There was no such thing. He had a girls' school. And they had a public test, a whole ceremony where they test them publicly. So Yaakov Ettlinger started with a drasha, and he said, first of all, you would think it looks like a confirmation. Confirmation was a Protestant ceremony that the Reform movement had adopted as one of theirs. It consists like at the age of 16 or so, they have like a public display, and they ask everybody again if they want to, you know, to confirm that now as adults they want to join the religion and so on and so forth. He said this looks like a confirmation, which is a goyish custom. And he said the reason over there is that they want that people should accept the religion themselves as adults. We believe that a Jew is b'nishmasei a Jew, and has no need for these religious ceremonies for that, and so on and so forth. He said, we're giving a test, and really, we should do it in the school, not in the shul, but I'm required by law to do it this way, and therefore I have to do it. So my sense is, it had to look like a confirmation. They had to do it because the government was mechayev it, and so on. And then he gave the test, and he said that... He gave the test, and after they finished the test, they then had a boys' choir sing the first 16 psukim of Perekov Yotes, and then the Rav darshaned, very beautiful Josh, he was very beautiful darshan, he darshaned about Shemayim and Oretz, two creations. I want to read the last part. Fascinating how he spoke to a group of 16-year-old girls in Germany. He says, now, He spoke to the parents, and then he says, and now to you, the girls who are now graduating from school, and you're probably very happy to become potter from learning. He says, don't fool yourself. From here on now, you're not going to have classes and lessons, but you're going to go into the great school of life itself. The worries, the troubles, the challenges that have been there till today will increase a lot more in the school of life. Also, the tests that scared you so much in school, you're going to get them in a much stronger dose in that school. And therefore, he says, strengthen yourself, don't give up. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will watch over you. As long as you go Darkei Hashem and you implement the mitzvahs, and you mekayim it where you were taught, they will lead you through this world like stars lead you through a dark night. If you go after the manhigim, manhigi emes, and you don't move away from derech Torah mitzvahs, I want to give you a bracha, yisimcha lakim kesara rivka rachel v'leah. The mothers of our nation should be your guiding path, the guiding stars, and you should be matzliach to adorn yourself with the pride of the Jewish moral values. That's how he spoke to them. It's very fascinating. This is way ahead of his times. So I guess to sum up, in many ways, he was really at the turning point from when the Dor reformed the 1700s. You had the Vilna Goyen, you had Rikki Vega was still there, and so on. It was the old generation. Things were like they were. The leaders, the Rav Shmuel and so on, was later. He was a bridge. He was tremendous Paisik. Rikki Vega writes, thanks him for the safe and writes Hagos and Oris on it, and tells the Baruch Shmuel Shekivanti. He himself produced the two leaders who would save the remnants of German Jewry, Hashan Shval Hirsch and Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer. He kept the balance between, and like he puts it, really the way which became the German Derech. He says, I also believe that Chodesh Asim Natera, but Chodesh means changing the Torah, not changing the world. If the world now has a printing press, we need to produce a Jewish newspaper. If they have schools, we need to produce Jewish schools. If they have machines that make matzahs much quicker, much more efficient, we need to make matzahs more quicker and efficient. You can't write a tshuva about something happening and say, I'm not sure, but I heard about it. That's not the way to approach halachs like that. His bezdin was recognized by the government. He was considered to be extraordinarily, his yashrus, his integrity. His whole bearing aroused so much kavod that he kept at least the chitzonius of keeping Yiddishkeit in Altoona. He kept because of his personage. It was kulay merkavet. He left. He wrote. He raised money to make a yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. This is, you're talking about the mid 1800s, and he said Torah is going to dissipate and fizzle out in Europe. It will only survive in Eretz Yisrael, and that's why we have to make a great yeshiva and send the boys to learn there. It's quite prescient. The way in which he balanced, there was a big shaila from Yerushalayim that came about a ger, famous shaila ger shemol v'le taval, if he's chayv mitzvahs, if he's mutter b'chal Shabbos, osv b'chal Shabbos, chayv b'chal Shabbos. And he bases his shuv a lot on, I've never seen a precedent for this, a tremendous faithfulness to Mesorah. On the other hand, he made a girl's school, and he understood he needed to do these things, but the ruach that he gave over was with tremendous Yerushalayim. That was him. He left over, I think it was Chaim Zonfeld said about him, he left over an interesting, he left over 8 Sfarim called Oruch Lener, and it was nifta the first night of Hanukkah. Or some sort of Nibbe Lerda Manibbe. Himself, his own life was a tremendous chassid and kaddish. He slept 3 hours a night. He was noig with tremendous precious. And yet, when he got his first rabbanus, he said the job of a rav is he has to be part of the He's not somebody who is apart from the He is part of the That's of the nation. That's what he has to be. And he was a dogma of that type of Rav Rabbanis, that he himself was above everyone, he was Malchustik, and yet he understood the people, lived it, and was able to put down his Yisoides for saving whatever remnants could be saved in the next generation. Okay. Yeah.